Appreciate very much the opportunity that you have given me this week to be with you. It's been good to be with you each night and to study God's Word and to meet people that I've not met before and get reacquainted with some people that I haven't known a whole lot very well, but and to be with, as George indicated, we go back a long ways with George and Nancy and Tommy and Jackie, and always good to be with them and to renew those acquaintances. And everything that you've done this week, been very hospitable and very kind, and I appreciate that very much. Want to look tonight at this section of Scripture and consider some things that are found in this. Now, when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And so he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those that are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Let's get the context in which these events and these words were spoken. Elisha, being a prophet of God, had been informing the king of Israel regarding the battle plans of the king of Aram. King of Aram was trying to engage in some warfare with the king of Israel. And through God, Elisha found out what the king of Aram's plans were. And he was telling the king of Israel that so the king of Israel could make evasive plans and dodge whatever it was that the evil king had in mind. Well, the king of Aram thought that some of his own people had been informing the king of Israel and made those kinds of accusations. But his servants that he accused said, "Oh no, it's not us. There's this guy Elisha, the prophet. And Elisha is the one who has been snitching. He's been informing the king of Aram as to what your plans are. He's the guy that you want." And so naturally the king of Aram wants to get Elisha. And he sends an army of horses and chariots to go down and get Elisha. And when Elisha's servant sees this army of horses and chariots, he cries out in the text that we're looking at, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" He saw something he didn't like. And in his despair, he made this cry. Obviously, I don't know about all of you, but I know enough about some of you to know this, that you in your life have faced your moments of despair. You've had things happen in your life, as I've had in my life, and nothing unique to me or to you, but things have happened which probably have caused you not only to feel despair, but to voice it. Could be the death of someone very close to you, in your family or friends, in the church, or news of someone's very serious illness, which may eventually bring about death. It could be what we talked about last night. It could be finding out about someone spiritually, that they have been making some moves away from the Lord. And you look at these things that happen, and you feel just like the servant of Elisha. And you say, what in the world are we going to do? This illness that we're facing, either with ourselves or with someone else, it's something I can't handle. Or someone's death, I can't cope with this. I don't know what in the world I'm going to do. It's at moments like this that we need to realize that God answers such questions. And He solves such problems. Our God's a loving God, and He will not allow us to face these moments of despair without giving us some help. And that's exactly what we see in this context. I believe in this context that there are some things that are said that will help us in the various times of despair that we face. And will help us go through them and meet those challenges in a way that will be successful. Doesn't mean we're not going to cry. Doesn't mean we're not going to hurt. But it does mean, as we'll see as we go further in our study, it does mean that God will be with us and that He'll help us. Let's first of all suggest this. One of the first things that we can do in moments of despair is to be realistic and to realize that we certainly have an enemy. In this context, it was an army with horses and chariots circling about the city. That was the enemy that the servant of Elisha saw. But we have an enemy far greater than that one. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Peter said, be sober-minded and be watchful. To be sober-minded is to act as if you are in control of yourself. Be sober-minded. And be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood or your brethren throughout the world. One of the first things that we need to believe in, and I don't know that we talk about this enough, but one of the things that we need to get back and start talking more about, perhaps, is the fact that there is a devil. There is an actual being called the devil. He is real. He does not dress up in a red suit. He does not have horns. He does not hold a pitchfork. It is not obvious most of the time that we're facing the devil. Perhaps we've been impacted too much by those around us who make fun of belief in the supernatural and so forth. But this is one aspect of the supernatural that we need to remind ourselves of on a daily basis. And that is that the biggest enemy we have in this world is the devil. I want to come back to that in just a moment. But I want to go to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. Paul gives us in Ephesians 6 more information about our enemy and what it is that we face on a daily basis. Ephesians 6 verse 10. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Now you'll notice, and I'm sure that you're familiar with this, but You'll notice in that reading that you have one of those not, but sentence constructions, in which the phrase after the word not is not what you emphasize, but rather the expression after the word but. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. That would be an untrue statement, because we do wrestle against flesh and blood. We do have enemies who are flesh and blood, men and women, young and old, and they present themselves to us as enemies, spiritual enemies. That's true. But Paul is not denying that. He's just comparing two types of enemies, and he's saying, this is the worst one. Now let's read again that phrase, or those phrases after the word but. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers. And he's not talking here about earthly rulers. But against the rulers, against the authorities. And these are not earthly authorities. Keep reading and you'll find out who these rulers are and where these authorities are. Against the cosmic powers over this present darkness. And now that last phrase, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. If you could, this is not going to be the last time I use this illustration tonight, but if you could just pull back the spiritual curtain that exists between heaven and earth and look behind it, you would see there rulers, authorities, cosmic powers, the agents of the devil. These are the ones who rule over the darkness. And they are busy at work with their boss, the devil, doing everything that they can to draw me away from God and to present every obstacle in the world they can present to cause me to lose my faith. That's my enemy. Now go back to 1 Peter chapter 5. Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil. I'm going to say this one time at the risk of you thinking whatever. The biggest enemy that we face today is not in some political party. Okay? The biggest enemy that we face today is not the leader of some political party. And I'm talking about either side of the political aisle. I'm not playing favorites here. The biggest enemy that we face today is not the leader of some liberal social movement. That's flesh and blood. And Paul said in Ephesians 6, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. That's not our real enemy. Those individuals are simply the agents doing the bidding of the devil. And the biggest adversary that we've got today is the devil. And when we lose sight of that, and we get it in our heads that some political movement or some social movement is our biggest enemy, and we focus our attention upon that, the devil is up there clapping his hands with glee because he's gotten you or he's gotten me to turn my attention away from him and focus upon flesh and blood. The devil causes death. He's the one who has the power over death. He's the one who has the power over all the things that are our obstacles in trying to serve God. And the sooner that we realize that, and the sooner we focus our attention upon and start blaming the devil for death, for sickness, all of those things, the better off we're going to be. And so, as we go back to our text, Elisha's servants' real problem was really not the army of horses and chariots that were encircling the city. His real problem, his real enemy, was the devil that was causing all of that to take place. And one more time, the sooner I realize who my enemy really is, and the sooner I start fighting my real enemy, the better off I'm going to be. But there's something else. What shall we do in moments of despair and moments of crisis? Don't fear the enemy. That's real easy to say. That's real easy. When Elisha said, "Do not fear," I don't believe here that the word fear means the fear that causes some trepidation, the fear that causes the sweaty palms, the fear that says, "Oh no." If that's what that meant, then explain Jesus in the garden. You think Jesus feared the cross? Yeah. Why then did Luke describe him sweating so profusely in the garden that sweat became, I believe, literally, blood mixed with sweat? That was the intensity of the emotion of Jesus. Sure. Jesus was deity, but Jesus also was a man. And he feared things. That's why he cried at the death of Lazarus. That's why he cried over Jerusalem when he saw the things that were taking place there. Jesus felt human emotion. And when I face death with myself, with my loved ones, when I hear the news of sickness and impending death, is it something that affects me emotionally? Absolutely. But that's not what's being talked about here. The word fear here means to stand in awe of something. It means to look at something and be in awe of it as if it is an insurmountable obstacle. It is in that sense that this servant was told, "Do not fear." Don't stand in awe of the horses and the chariots that are circling the city. Back to 1 Samuel, chapter 17. Familiar story to us, one that unfortunately has become just a kiddie story. And I have no problem with using this story of David and Goliath in our children's classes, but we need to realize that this has an application to adults as well. The giant Goliath, some 9 foot tall, 9 foot plus perhaps tall, comes out, challenges the army of Israel. Who's going to come out and overtake me? Verse 11 says, "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." They had the same kind of fear that Elisha's servant had. They were looking at Goliath as an obstacle that could not be overcome. It was impossible. And then down in verse 24, the fear of the king, Saul, was infectious. All the men of Israel, verse 24, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. All through the army, from the very top to the very bottom, they looked at Goliath and they thought, "This is too much. We can never get past this. We can never crawl over this," so to speak. It's that kind of fear that when we are confronted with death, it's that kind of fear that we cannot give into. Whenever we face some horrible illness, and I'm not trying to trivialize death and sickness, not that at all. I'm not saying that on the one hand we don't have those emotions, but on the other hand, we don't look at death as something that cannot be overcome, at sickness that something that cannot be overcome. Look in the book of Mark. Mark chapter 4 and verse 35. The disciples of Jesus had this same problem. "And on that day when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side,'" this, "the other side of the Sea of Galilee. "And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. and a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you no faith?" Jesus defines their fear as a fear that lacked faith. Have you no fear? Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith? And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And I think we are perfectly right to make an analogy here. Between the storm and the rough sea on the Sea of Galilee that caused these disciples of Jesus to allow their faith to weaken, and thinking that this storm could not be overcome. And the same thing that takes place in our life, when we have our own storms. We have our own windy conditions. We have our own boat that's rocking. And we're afraid. Not the human emotion fear, but we look upon whatever it is that's causing the storm as an obstacle that simply cannot be overcome. But the advice of Elisha and the implication of Jesus here is, don't be afraid. Don't have that kind of fear. Jesus can overcome every obstacle. And here's why. Here's why we should not be characterized by this kind of fear. By the kind of fear that says we have met something that we cannot overcome. God has His own horses and chariots. But I want you to notice something. Back up in the first part of this reading, when he's talking about the horses and the chariots of the king of Aram, notice that it says, an army with horses and chariots. But look at the underlined phrase. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire. Men may have their horses and chariots, but God has His horses and chariots of fire. God has a power that men do not have. He has the ability to overcome things that men alone cannot overcome. Turn to the Revelation chapter 12, please. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 7. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. Now, I mentioned a moment ago, I said something about taking this curtain, as it were, that stands between heaven and the spiritual realm, the heavenly realm. If we could, and I know that we can't, but if we could draw that curtain back and look up there. Revelation 12 and verse 7 is what you'd see. You'd see war in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and his angels. If you ever want somebody to come work with you and talk to you all about angels, and you want it to be a short series, call me. It won't take me very long. But verses like this seem to be rather clear. That God has His angels and the devil has his angels. And they are fighting. The devil has horses and chariots that he's using, but Michael and his angels, all of those were the agents of God. God and Michael and his angels have horses and chariots of fire. They have a power behind them that the devil and his angels do not have. And whenever those obstacles are thrown up against us, and we think that we have met our Goliath, we think that we have met our sinking ship, just remember, God has horses and chariots of fire. Now let's go to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 3, where the friends of Daniel are thrown into a fiery furnace. Now again, I'm going to analogize here, and I think properly so. What happened to the servant of Elisha was he had been thrown, as it were, into a fiery furnace. He, as it were, was meeting Goliath. He, as it were, was in a sinking boat. These three young men had been placed into a literal fiery furnace because they decided to obey God and not the king. Now let's begin reading with verse 24 of Daniel chapter 3. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. Now the reason he was astonished was he was sitting there and he was looking into that fiery furnace. And all of a sudden, he got real amazed. He declared to his counselors, this would be borderline humorous if it weren't so serious. Try to picture the scenario. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? They said, yeah, true, O king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, but I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Three young men were cast into that fire. Nebuchadnezzar saw four. Let's keep reading for several verses and conclude with verse 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, the governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Now notice verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, and he spoke the truth here, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants. That's the fourth one that Nebuchadnezzar saw. Of course, we all know God doesn't do things like this anymore. Really? Really? And I don't believe that. I'm not saying that we can see God's ministering spirits. I'm not saying that. But I believe with all of my heart that when we, our children, are cast into whatever fiery furnace that the devil has prepared, I firmly believe, based upon these statements and others, that God can and that God will, in ways that we do not understand and cannot figure out, send his messengers and his ministers to be our aid. And I no more am able to answer the how of that question than I'm able to answer the how of how Mary got pregnant without a man. I just know that it happened. The idea that God, this is a good time to say this, I guess, but the idea that our God will not work miracles today is something that we need to take another look at. And I'm not saying, not talking about men possessing spiritual gifts, and I don't believe in that, but God can do things. God can act in ways that we have no idea about. And what should I do when I face my moments of despair? I need to realize that God has horses and chariots of fire at His disposal, and He can and He will send them. And when you send your children off to school or to whatever scenario, and you pray, God watch over them, God protect them, what are you praying for? If you're not praying for God to act in only ways that God can to watch over and protect, what's the point of prayer? We'll talk about that more in a moment. If we don't believe that. What shall we do whenever we find ourselves in times of despair? Need to remember that me plus God and His hosts always make a majority. 1 + 1 = 10,000,000 to the 95th power, whatever number you choose. Romans 8, verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? You believe that? That's exactly what Elisha was telling his servant. For those who are with us are more than those who are with them. That will always be the case. Three young men in a fiery furnace up against the entire Babylonian Empire, and God sent one angel to get in there, and the battle was won. And let me take you back to Revelation chapter 17, verse 14. We looked at this Sunday morning. This is the best commentary ever written on the Revelation. They will make war on the Lamb, that is the devil and his host. And the Lamb will conquer them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with Him are called and chosen and faithful. God plus me and His host always means I win. And never forget it. This last, toward the first part of this year, I guess, we did a study of the life of Paul. We just went through the epistles, just getting an overview of the epistles. And I saw something. It's amazing what you read the Bible through a bunch of times, and all of a sudden you read it for the next time. You say, oh, I never did notice that. One thing that I noticed throughout, and I'm not going to read these verses. These are from the prison epistles, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. But one thing I noticed was, how many times in the epistles did Paul say, I'm praying for you, and I'm praying for you, and I'm praying for you, and for you, and I told the classmate, I said, you know, if Paul was serious, and I think that he was, don't get me wrong. If Paul was serious, if he really prayed for that many people in that many churches, and those are just the ones that are written in the epistles, can you imagine how much time Paul spent in prayer? It had to have been an immense amount of time to pray for all those people and all those churches. Does that give new meaning to what he told Thessalonica? Pray without ceasing? You think Paul was a man of prayer? When was the last time that you heard about some horses and chariots that were surrounding your loved one, your brother or sister in Christ, yourself or anybody else? When was the last time you saw those horses and chariots circling and you failed to talk to God about it? Paul was a man of prayer. And Paul knew that what Elisha did was exactly right. Then Elisha prayed. And he prayed for his servant, God, open his eyes that he can see. That he can see the horses and the chariots of fire that God had. Think God answers prayer? Think he hears prayer? Here's the next thing we need to realize when we face these moments of crisis. Jehovah answers prayer. The statement in Psalms, Psalm 6, depart from me, all you who do iniquity, for the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. He has heard, not he may hear, he has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication. The Lord receives my prayer. God hears prayer. And God answers prayer. Let me relate one thing to you. Sort of tie some things together that we just got through talking about. It's been 5 or 6 years ago, I guess, something like that, that one of the men in the Parkway Church in Corpus was diagnosed with cancer. And doctors assured him that he had cancer and assured his wife that he had, and they were going to do surgery on Monday, not to find out whether or not he had cancer, but to see just the extent of it and the nature of it and so forth. And so we did something that we've done before at Parkway. Everybody was concerned about Dan. And so on Sunday night when we all came together, we just dismissed everything that we had planned. And we prayed for an hour. We just started on this side of the building. Any of the men who want to pray, just like you do with the singing. We prayed for an hour. That was Sunday night. Monday morning, a bunch of us were at the hospital. And Dan went into surgery. An hour or so later, they came out and told his wife to come on back. The doctor was ready to talk to her. The surgery was over. And Liz was gone for about 10 minutes. And when she came back into the waiting area, she was just crying. And we thought, oh. And when she composed herself and could talk, the first words out of her mouth were, Dan doesn't have cancer. And the doctors can't figure it out. The doctor said, it was there. Now, I know what I'm sounding like, and I really don't care. The doctor said, it was there. But it's not there anymore. Think God doesn't hear and answer prayer. Now, I'm not saying God answers prayer in every way you want it to be answered. You may want a yes and get a no. You may get a no and want a yes. But God's a little bit smarter than me. God hears prayer, and God answers prayer. And in these times when we, what are we going to do? And talk to God about it. Turn it over to God. And God will handle it in the way and in the time that he sees fit. What shall we do? I'd suggest that when we come to those moments in our lives and we feel like that the world has just crashed on top of us, that we remember the servant of Elisha and remember what Elisha said and did when his servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? Let's stand and sing.